Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is currently the 13th of December 2012. Once again, we are joined for our monthly conversation by the Geneva Business Insider, a.k.a. David L. Smith, who is at GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com. Of course, I'll link that up in the show notes for today's episode, along with his YouTube channel, where you can find out more about the information that he provides on a regular basis. But David, you are now a regular guest on the Corbett Report, so it's good to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us again today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Well, it's always good to get your perspective there from Europe about what's happening in the Eurozone crisis, which, of course, is starting to feed out or has been feeding out into the greater world markets for a number of years now. And we see a lot of things coming to a head, including some of the most recent news, a kind of interesting drama of sorts playing out in Italy, where it seems that Silvio Berlusconi is going to once again try to take over the premiership of Italy from Mario Monti, who people might remember was parachuted in by Goldman Sachs and the banksters to take over Italy several months ago. Well, now Berlusconi is now apparently going to threaten that. Your take on what's happening there in Italy and how this is likely to play out in Italy and in the broader European markets?
Yeah, well, I find it fascinating. I've lived and worked for almost 3 years in Italy, so it's a country whose language and culture I understand very well. And at the time I was living there, Berlusconi was also a major figure, but usually in his doubtful business dealings and his maneuverings within his television empire. So, yes, I know a little bit the story. I mean, to me, when I look at Berlusconi, his main maneuver at the moment is to try and get back into political office to make sure that he doesn't end up in prison where bunga bunga opportunities are less limited or at least certainly less available from the members of the opposite sex. So I think that that's his primary concern, is get back in power and stay out of prison. The thing that's always fascinating about Italy is, to my mind, the pragmatism of the people. So to go along with someone like a Monti has been quite good for them over the last 12 months. I mean, basically, they have got themselves under the radar because they have the protection of somebody who is highly regarded and respected by the Brussels on Berlin mafia. So it has actually probably turned more attention to Spain. And of course, now we're coming to the end of the game where people then wake up again and go back to playing politics. And Monti is being maneuvered out of the scene by the resurgence of the Italian local politics. Now, they're pragmatic people, as I say. You know, so long as they think they're getting something out of it, they'll play low profile. And now they're going back to being Italian, which I think is actually rather wonderful, because this is what democracy is all about.
Well, it is an interesting situation in a number of ways. One of the things that I find interesting about this is that as soon as we saw this announcement that Monti was going to step down and the elections were going to be held in February, we saw a destabilization in Italian markets. We saw Italian bond yields shoot up a little, which shows that I think the banksters really do have their gun to the heads of the Italian people in a lot of ways by, threatening, basically, if you even threaten to try to replace the person that we put into power, the markets are going to treat you poorly and you're going to have to pay more for your debt, which is, I think, a sign of really who's holding the cards in all of this. And it also brings to my mind the question of why the Italian people would even consider Berlusconi again. Is he taken seriously politically in Italy for any other reason than the fact that he does wield so much political power?
Well, I was with some Italian people last night and we were talking about exactly this. And quite a lot of them were saying that they felt he'd shot himself in the foot. But it is a game that he can play. I find it difficult to imagine that he's going to get back where he used to be. But one never knows. I mean, I don't really see what the viable alternatives are. I think we'll just have to watch and let it play itself out.
I suppose we will, and it will be interesting to see how that does play out. It seems that Deutsche Bank is already counting on a Monti win, so we'll have to see if their predictions play out for 2013. But moving on to some other areas of the Eurozone, of course, Greece still unfolding and the interesting things that are taking place there. Of course, they just completed a recent bond buyback program, which was one of the conditions towards freeing up further bailout money. And it seems that as we sit here on Thursday, the 13th of December, the Eurozone finance ministers are meeting and are expected to back the next batch of aid money to Greece, another 34 billion euro. That's going to kick in to basically help Greece survive another several months. So what do you think are the ramifications for this, for the Eurozone overall? And what kind of message is this sending to the other Euro countries that are on the teetering on the brink of collapse?
Well, I think if we look at an amount of 34 billion euro, we've just watched America yesterday in the form of Mr. Bernanke announce 85 billion dollars per month buyback. So 34 billion euro in the worlds of international finance is, you know, a couple of months' pocket money, which can be printed up out of nowhere. So Greece, I think, is just a political football. I mean, they want to have a clear demonstration of how unpleasant life can become if you try to stand up to the central powers within Europe. In particularly Germany, where this kind of perpetual instability has the impact of weakening the euro, and they being the strongest country within the weak zone, profit from that to help along exports to their neighbors, and indeed all around the world. I mean, the pressing down the exchange rate of the euro makes them competitive in China and the export markets the U.S. would also like to tackle. So it's Greece is a convenient football, and 34 billion euro is petty cash. And everybody knows perfectly well that the genuine debts of Greece are utterly, utterly unreimbursable under any conditions. So all they're doing is keeping the lie going and the music playing. Well, I don't think if you were actually had them being honest, they would know perfectly well it wasn't going to plug it up, but it's just pushing the can down the road, as the saying goes. And, you know, the only problem with that is other people who see these deals being offered to Greece, namely countries like Ireland or Portugal or eventually Spain and in due course Italy. All of these countries say, well, you know, we want this kind of you know, debt write down and partial bailout. You know, but the trouble is, some of them are too big to be protected in that particular way.
Exactly right. It's so much about perceptions, and of course, when the other countries are on the outside looking in at what's happening in Greece, I think there's going to be it's going to play on some of the tensions that are already there within the Eurozone, which I'd like to ask you about. But before we do that, you just did mention the Federal Open Markets Committee's meeting in Washington this week. Can you tell people who don't know what was announced there and what's going to happen as Operation Twist expires at the end of this month?
Well, Operation Twist, basically what has happened now is that Operation Twist has been replaced by a program of unlimited, unsterilized bond buying. So we now have a situation where the Fed will be printing 85 billion a month or over a trillion a year. And this ultimately will have a very negative inflationary impact. Now, the other thing the Fed have announced is that for citizens who have any savings, the money is going to be worth nothing for many years to come until they reach an unemployment target, which by all imaginings, given the continued outsourcing of activities from America and decline of the domestic economy, they are never going to get to a 6.5% unemployment figure, possibly in my lifetime. I hope they do so in your lifetime, but maybe not in mine. So the whole thing is just, once again, for me, it's a farce. What has been very interesting over the last few days is the endless pounding that the gold and silver have been receiving, which is always the Fed's or the government's approach to making announcements which are very bullish for gold and silver, is you have to attack it mercilessly before you make those announcements. So it'll be interesting to see now that the real truth is out, what actually happens to gold and silver. But I would expect them to rally significantly when people fully understand the implications of endless money printing without time limit and without interest rates rising and without anything at all which can favor a currency which is just increasingly becoming confetti.
And given the way that gold and silver continues to be manipulated downwards, at least this might present a bit of an opportunity before things start back on the uptick. Well, it is interesting that you point out that now the Fed's quantitative easing plan is not tied to any specific date, but to an employment figure target, 6.5%, that they want to get unemployment down to before they stop this program, ostensibly. At any rate, it allows them to frame this as if what they really care about is the way this trickles down into the real economy. And, oh, well, they really care about people getting employed, so they can at least frame it that way, which is a nice way of stating what they're doing, right?
Well, I mean, the truth is a complete diametric opposite. They couldn't give a damn about the people at all. All they want to do is keep taking bad assets off bank balance sheets and keep the banking system afloat. And what is also deeply disturbing is seeing that Mr. Carney, who is one of your compatriots, is coming in to take over in the Bank of England in about 6 months' time. And he's already making speeches to the effect of basically mirroring what the Fed has done in the last 24 hours. Now, I would never have said that Mervyn King was a good governor of the Bank of England, but at least he tried to say, well, we should have some austerity, we should not print money. Now what we have is someone who is more or less doing the same thing, hinting at GDP targeting, which will undoubtedly devastate the UK's sterling exchange rate in due course.
That's right. And for people who don't know, this is former Bank of Canada Governor Mark Carney, who's now being shipped over to the Bank of England, which, as far as I understand, is unprecedented. I've never heard of a move like this taking place before. Do you have any inkling of an idea why this was done? Why did Mark Carney get picked out of the air to become the next Bank of England governor? And what direction is it going to head in with under his stewardship?
Well, for me, it's pretty clear. I mean, the objective of all of this is that Goldman Sachs gets its full, complete control over everything to do with central banking on a global basis. Now, once you have got a firm grip on the EU with Mr. Draghi, the UK is an extremely important and powerful central bank, being the biggest or second biggest capital market center in the world. So you want to have a Goldman Sachs guy there. So you look at his track record, he's been with Goldman Sachs for years. He's gone to Canada, and to my interpretation, as far as Canada is concerned, he's getting out while the time is right, because he has basically fueled in Canada a potential for the same kind of collapse that we've witnessed in the US. There's been a tremendous run-up in personal credit by Canadian citizens. There's been a tremendous run-up also in property values. Interest rates have been driven down to very low levels. And of course, everyone is saying, what a genius this guy has been. But for the moment, to my analysis, all he's been a genius at is blowing up a bubble and leaving before it bursts. So I think for me, his track record is extremely proven if you look at it in detail. And this is exactly what Goldman Sachs wants him to do in the UK as well.
It's like Bubbles Greenspan. He got out at the right time, I suppose, as well, so as not to take the fall for what happened. But certainly, just blowing up the bubbles and waiting for them to pop. Well, then let's return our gaze to Europe for a moment, because I think you pointed out something interesting and important earlier, which is some of the tensions inside the Eurozone, which it might be difficult for those on the outside in North America and elsewhere around the world to really understand what's happening in terms of some of the internal squabbles. I think a lot of people around the world have bought into the European Union propaganda that it is all just one big happy family now and everyone gets along. But of course, there are deep and abiding divisions culturally, linguistically, and every other way, economically, between the different countries of the Eurozone. What do you think this portends for the actual ability of any group, the European Central Bank or any other, to actually unite them in some sort of federation?
Well, I think what you have is a political class who want to political and financial class, I should say, who want to reunite them all, mainly to consolidate their power. But underlying all of this, there are countries who have been at war with each other not all that long ago. you take Germany, for example, and you look at the lifespan of somebody like Angela Merkel. You know, her parents were involved in dealing with the Stasi in Eastern Europe. She's lived through that period. She's on the other side of the Berlin Wall. She certainly had grandparents who lived through the Weimar Republic and hyperinflation. Her predecessor, for example, his father went to the Romanian campaign and never came back when he was, when he was a two-year-old child. So all of these things are very deeply ingrained into people's mentality. You take Britain, it's the same thing. We were a country of empire. I still count myself as British, although I've got Swiss citizenship as well. But we fought the Germans when no one else was prepared to do it. We are an island nation. We are very proud. We are lots of things. The French, well, you know, they have had the same thing. They've lived in the shadow of Germany and occasionally in the Napoleonic time even dominated Germany. So all of these things are deeply ingrained in the culture. If you go to other areas like further south, like the Balkans and Yugoslavia, it's not 20 years since we had a European war in that region. So all of these things, plus the fact that languages are different. I mean, I've lived and worked in many European countries. I speak four different languages. And it makes, for example, understanding Italians or French or Germans reasonably easy. But boy, I wouldn't like to get inside the mind of a Greek or an Albanian, because I've never lived there, seen it, and felt it. And when you see the kind of people who come and are making these decisions or observing, I'll give you an example not so long ago of one of the American ambassadors in the Bush era, who arrived in Greece to become the ambassador to Switzerland. And he was basically a campaign fundraiser for the Bush family. And his first and only significant question was, I'm flying my horses over, where can I get them stabled? So is this the guy who is going to understand a country like Switzerland that's got 700 years of history? There are four different languages, depending on how you count them around the country. And, I don't know how to say hi-ho silver away in four different languages, but that's about all our ambassador could do before he was unceremoniously removed once Bush had gone. So it is really a fairly sad testimony to the way it works. The European supranational elites want to make an abstraction of all this and pretend it doesn't exist. And it's the same with the international financial community. And when it really comes down to it, you know, these countries are bonded together by hundreds of years of history, by language, by culture, by religion, generally shared values. And I do not see how, when there's pressure coming, which is created outside, the thing will hang together. I think it's an artifact which is destined to fail. However, before we get to that failure, it is going to get grotesque. And the first indications of how grotesque it can get are looking at places like Greece and the riots in the street and people shooting themselves or committing suicide and all the rest of it. And then if we come to the ultimate joke, I think the ultimate joke in the European region is the recent award of a Nobel Prize to the European Union. Now, I think they've had a run-up to this ultimate joke by doing things like giving the same prize to Henry Kissinger or Yasser Arafat. I mean, the basic criteria to get it seems you need to kill hundreds of thousands of people and then eventually stop. And then you get your Nobel Peace Prize, but, you know, those who are actually peaceful never get them. And I see no link whatsoever between the Nobel Peace Prize and anything the EU have done. Arguably, one could have said that NATO might have won it because they were actually the iron fist that could could actually stop something going wrong. But for a bunch of brainless politicians on a sort of mutual admiration society trip, I think it's a complete and tragic joke.
Someone with a very sick sense of humor must be really making the decisions there with the Peace Prize Committee. But you paint a very vivid portrait of the divisions that exist there in Europe and why this is a project that's doomed to fail. And it does, of course, beg the question of why are they trying to do this? Is this just simply hubris of the people at the top? Are they simply so disconnected that they actually don't realize this? Or is this just part of a generational project to basically wear down the will of the people?
I think you summarized it pretty well. It's a combination of all of it. I mean, the worst thing is this kind of power-mad, dissociated politician who sees no contradiction in watching, Greek people in hospital without enough medication and flying off in a private jet to discuss it and asking for an increase in their in the budget and then complaining very strongly at the fact the British Prime Minister, who had said, well, you know, we shouldn't increase it, we should just maintain it at its current levels of a modest $220 billion a year. Now, these are telephone numbers which are being taken out of the pockets of ordinary people. And if you look then at what goes beyond it, I mean, their concerns are to make sure that they get cash flow without actually having to go back and beg from individual governments. So then you come into things like carbon taxes, which could be conveniently rolled into a central pot of money, which the UN and the EU just divvy up among themselves as they want. So then you lose financial control over the people. It's very clear that we have lost political control over them, because if you take a country like the UK, about 50 or 60% of their legislation is generated in Brussels by unelected, headless, bureaucratic puppets. And the UK is there just to ratify and impose. And you see just completely aberrant situations of legislation saying that people who are in prison should be allowed to vote, or you're unable to get rid of people who are clearly detrimental in trying to and trying to destabilize your country, because there's some international rules that say that you cannot protect your own interests. So,
well, if there's any bright spot, I suppose it's that the UNFCCC COP18 conference just came and went in Doha and came out with no alternative to Kyoto, and there's not going to be any new mechanism for collecting the taxes of the people and rolling them up into a ball for the UN. So that is some sort of bright spot, I suppose, for the world economy. Well, I've been peppering you with questions. Anything else on your radar that you'd like to bring to the attention of the listeners?
I think for the moment we've had a pretty good tour of the world there. We've been from Doha to America to all around Europe. I think that's pretty good for today. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, let's just tell people once again about the website and what they can find there and what services you offer.
Very good. Well, my website is www.genevabusinessinsider.blogspot.com. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it at least identifies who I am and where I am. My basic business is financial advice of different kinds. I do these broadcasts on a regular basis with one or two people, most notably with the Corbett Report, which gives me great pleasure. And if you wish to know more, look on my Blogspot, and from there you'll see a link to my business website, the list of services, and if I can be of any help to you, do not hesitate to contact me.
Excellent. Well, David L. Smith, always a pleasure talking to you. So until the new year, I suppose that will do it for today. So thank you again for your time.
Very good. Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure.